Stay tuned next for Art Focus with your host, Joseph Gallivan, after the following announcement.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale coming soon, and we are accepting donations now. The sale will be held sometime this fall at the Volunteers of America building, 537 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. The book and record sale is a great way to help contribute to your community. So do us and yourself a favor. Clear out those books, comics, DVDs, VHS tapes, LPs, and CDs collecting dust around your abode and bring them down to the station. 20 Southeast 8th Avenue during our business hours. Got questions? Contact Jesse at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer@kboo.org. Remember, the stuff that you're sick of, others may treasure. Turn your clutter into cash for your community radio station, KBOO.
Like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Nicola Lopez. Her show, Forecasting an Impossibly Possible Tomorrow, is on now at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery through September the 27th. Welcome to KBOO, Nicola.
Thank you.
So you printed a lot of silkscreen on mylar, which is thin plastic material, semi-transparent. And when you walk into the gallery, on the left, on the big wall, there is one very imposing installation. It's stuck to the wall, but it's off the wall a little in different layers. And it's mainly white and gray. The lines are gray and blue.
Yeah, it's kind of the installation on the left is called Barren Lands Breed Strange Visions. And it's an installation that's actually constructed from some silkscreen elements, some woodcut also, and some monoprint on mylar. And each one of the elements is printed separately and then cut out. So I have, when I begin putting things together, I actually have a large spread of images kind of scattered around my studio. And when I construct the installation, it's really a matter of kind of playing with them and putting them together to see what fits, and kind of putting something together and taking it apart again and rebuilding it and taking it apart again. So it's like making a drawing out of prefabricated elements, and then they get adhered together so that they'll stay in that configuration. And as you said, they're hung just slightly off the wall. So it's actually a nail sticking out of the wall, and then magnets kind of pinning the installation piece between the magnet and the nails.
Those tiny little super strong magnets you get in
Yeah, that's right. You have to mail order them.
Do you?
I do. I mail because I buy them by the hundreds.
So the piece is called Barren Lands Breed Strange Visions, and it's a image of collapsing tall buildings.
Yeah, you know,
what is it?
It's either collapsing tall buildings or building tall buildings or mutating tall buildings. And, you know, I'm not quite sure what they're doing either, because the idea is that it's this landscape that is in flux, and that it's impossible to really pin down what's happening at any given moment, probably because it's doing all of the above. You know, just as, you know, you walk through any city and there are buildings that are coming down, that are being built up, and, you know, it's all part of kind of the greater life cycle of an urban environment. So it does, it shows that there's some skeletal structures within these buildings that are maybe the kind of rebar, the, you know, steel I-beams, just the skeletons that are either waiting to be clad or that are the remnants of something that once was. And these buildings are fantastical. You know, it would probably be pretty tricky to actually build them. You'd have to deal with gravity in an interesting way. You know, but the idea is that there are these hybrid buildings that have almost taken on a life of their own. They're kind of Frankensteinian. There are little fragments of different kinds of recognizable buildings, and they're all glommed together almost as though it's kind of started to grow organically.
Did you build the piece and then finish it and then bring it to Portland and construct it, or did you change it sort of when you got here?
In this particular case, I actually finished it in my own studio and made a really extensive map, a kind of template to be able to reconstruct it here in exactly the same way. I do sometimes, often do site-specific installations where the piece won't actually exist or be finalized until I get to the site where it's shown. But in this case, it was made in the studio, and it's an interesting process to put it up someplace else because the templating is pretty extensive.
Some people might remember you had a piece at the Oregon College of Arts and Crafts 7 years ago.
No, that's actually up currently. It's a piece that was created 7 years ago. It's called Half-Life.
Oh, okay. It was created 7 years ago?
It was created 7 years ago in 2007, and it was published at Tandem Press. And it's in the collection of Jordan Schnitzer. So he's generously loaned it to OCAC, and it's on display also through next month.
And is the forms are a bit more organic?
They are a bit more organic. They're still very mechanical, industrial, technological. You know, there are flowers, but if you look closely, the flowers are actually kind of satellite dishes that are split open like petals, like flower petals. So they're kind of evil flowers.
Right. Is that kind of vision dystopian, or what is it too simple to say, you know, the built environment is going wrong?
Yeah, I'd like to resist a really clear black and white utopian dystopian, although I confess that that piece probably is more dystopian than anything else. You know, I do think that that our built environment is going wrong in many ways, but it also harbors a tremendous amount of beauty. And, you know, I find myself impressed and very, very excited about a lot of the things that we're building. It's not as simple as, you know, condemning it and saying it's terrible, period. But yeah, that piece I think is a little bit more kind of creepy and a little bit more dystopian. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it was made 7 years ago.
Correct.
So what's changed in you since then?
Oh, a lot of things have probably changed in me since then. But I don't think that I've shifted away from one end of the spectrum in terms of optimist, pessimist. Mm-hmm. It was actually interesting. We had there was a nice opening for that installation a couple of nights ago, and I was in a conversation where somebody asked me, "Well, are you a pessimist or are you an optimist?" And it's a question that I've been asked many times, and I feel that I'm optimistic about some things. I'm not a terribly negative. Yeah, I don't think it's all going downhill in a way that we can't remedy. But I do think that. And this is addressed in the work, that a lot of the built environment is leading to very negative consequences and is fundamentally unsustainable. So I would say that I'm maybe a short-term optimist and a long-term pessimist.
Mm-hmm. There are some collages. There are five collages in the Elizabeth Leach Gallery called the Babel Cycle stills.
Yeah.
So these are stills from a video you made, but you've taken the elements that you used to make the video and put them in frames, basically arranged them and made them into a solid final, you know, image. What do people see?
That's right. Well, technically what you're seeing when you walk in and you see those five collaged stills is silkscreen images printed out onto Mylar, and then they're cut out, and those are just arranged on foam core and adhered into place. So you're seeing, you know, literally a physical collage of elements. And then there's some strips, some blue strips that are supposed to mimic painter's tape, that blue painter's tape. Mm-hmm. And it's actually made through monoprint on Mylar and cut out and adhered in the same way. And you were talking about the video that's also on display in the second room in the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a piece that I did playing around with these silkscreened elements. Every installation that I make is, when it's displayed, it's just a still piece. But in the process, there's this story that happens that really corresponds to the narrative that's embedded in the work about the constructed environment, about something that is being built and then shifted around, and then being built and shifted around. And that's really what I end up doing when I'm composing the image.
Oh, okay.
So in a way, this video is just a literalization, a kind of presentation of that process where I'm figuring out this final image. So it's going towards a large tower. All of these pieces are being put together, and I'm just photographing every step mm-hmm. of the way. So in my studio, I had the camera set up, pointed at the wall where I was composing this tower, and then also documenting the tower falling down, and then it gets built again, and then falls down again, and builds again, and falls down again.
So this is a 8-minute stop motion video. People go in, stand there in the dark, look at it, the white screen,
exactly.
And then these little images come out. Some of them are recognizable, like the Arc de Triomphe, you know, different ziggurats, things like that. And they move around in a sort of jerky way, and they're being built up and up and up to the shape of what looks like the Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
And it collapses, and it does that several times over 8 minutes.
Yeah, and it, you know, the title is The Babel Cycle, and it's really about that building and then that cyclical nature. It's doomed to fall. Mm-hmm. But then we can't resist it. You know, as human beings, we have this deep ambition and this aspiration to build something that's going to reach the heavens and just to be the most that we possibly can be. And I think that there's something really beautiful about that impulse.
You ever see kids doing drip sandcastles at the ocean?
Oh, yeah.
We drip the liquid sand.
Yeah, and you want to build it as tall as you possibly can, and then, of course, it tumbles,
mm-hmm.
right? Or the sea takes it, or something happens, and so then you build another one, right? And then something happens to that one, and then you build another one. And this is kind of what I see reflected in this piece, and actually in the entire show, I think, is about that desire to build this kind of really beautiful and poignant and powerful ambition, but within that hope is embedded this seed of failure. You know it's going to fall. You know that it is unsustainable, that it is kind of too much for the place on which it's built.
Is this your first video?
It is my first video. It's
right.
Yeah.
And you worked with...
Tim Young is the musician who composed an original score for this piece. And I was so excited about the music that he created for it.
And did you have like all the real gear, the real stop motion gear? Or were you just improvising with consumer gear?
The stop motion gear, I think, can be pretty remedial. This is really old school. It's really stupid. I'm not savvy with editing. It's not really fancy digital work. It's really just my camera, which isn't so great.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just pointed at the studio wall. And I put one piece up, snap a photo. Put another piece up, snap a photo. And then to edit it, I just strung them all together. And there's really minimal mm-hmm. editing of anything else.
But by making a video, you wanted to show what you normally do when you're arranging pieces in the studio.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really think of it as a didactic, you know, tool or really showing so much to illustrate my process. I just realized that my process really does this thing that could be taken advantage of, that could turn into a piece where it's about the narrative, not just about the final product.
And why do you use silkscreen?
So actually, those silkscreen pieces were created at Middlebury College in Vermont, where I had been invited to do a print project with some of the students. We produced an additioned work that was built out of those little silkscreened elements, and I had all of these silkscreen elements left over. You know, I had an extra day in their studio, and I just started playing around and made something that was very, very raw. But I was really excited about it and saw the potential for making a longer video piece out of this, a longer stop motion animation piece. And so that was what led to the Babel Cycle that's on display in the gallery now.
Mm-hmm. Had you explored the story of the Tower of Babel before?
Yeah, it is. It's a story that's appeared in other works tangentially. You know, the viewer might not necessarily know that was the inspiration for it, but I find it a really strong story and something that really speaks of the potential that we as human beings have for creation and for, you know, for technological aspiration and reach, but also the vulnerability and the fragility that these objects that we create really have. And I think that those two things, that ambition and that frailty, are really wrapped in together. And I find that compelling, a really compelling part of the story.
Could you explore it in other ways, in other media?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting looking at this show. I feel as though each one of the different pieces or groups of work address this story in different ways. And so the animation is a moving narrative. The stills are, you know, the silkscreen collage. I feel that the installation, you know, being woodcut and mylar, but the the fact that it's a large kind of fixed image is different. And then one of the other pieces or groups of work in the show, Ideal Structures for a Dubious Future, is a very different medium. But I think that it also explores it in an interesting way. And that's, it's a suite of intaglio prints. And I'm calling them explosive intaglios because the process is not traditional at all. It's not like other etchings that use acids or just direct kind of hand-propelled tools to alter the surface of a copper plate. I actually used explosives to create the image.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Nicola Lopez, a visual artist whose show Forecasting an Impossibly Possible Tomorrow is on now at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery, and it runs through September 27th. So, Nicola, you were just talking about explosives, and I understand you from the desert, and tell me how you went about making explosions and turning them into art.
That's right. I was very lucky to be able to work with this particular medium. You know, most print shops don't have explosives in the back room. You know, I don't have a firing range in my studio. It was with the support of the New Mexico Small Business Assistance Program in the state of New Mexico. So being from there, I also do a lot of work out there. And I had wanted to experiment with using explosives to shape copper plates and then use those copper plates to make printed images. And this program links small businesses with facilities that and expertise that you can't get in any other way other than through either Sandia National Labs or Los Alamos National Labs. So I ended up working at Los Alamos National Labs with Bryce Tappan, a chemist up there.
Hang on, what Los Alamos National Labs, what do they do there again?
That's right.
These days?
These days...
They're still letting off atomic bombs?
I don't think so.
No? What are they doing?
I don't know that much about what they're doing now other than the fact that some of it, I'm sure, is military related and some of it is absolutely not. I know that they're investigating in other areas as well, but that's... Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So you said I need to use explosives and they set you up.
Yeah. So I was collaborating with a chemist up there who knows how to do this stuff because obviously I don't know how to do it. Basically, we used explosive blasts to shape this copper plate. And the images are similarly architectural towers. So maybe tied into that notion of the Tower of Babel. And they're these impossible structures that are absolutely giant if you kind of break it down into its respective pieces and realize that this is a Mesoamerican temple, huge, topped by another one, huge, topped by, you know, electric power towers, huge, topped by something else, right? So it's this kind of hybrid agglomeration of architectural structures that quote often actually visionary structures, visionary architecture, utopian buildings that some of which have been built and some of which haven't been built. And because they're created through this explosive process, you know, I think that feeds into the concept. It's really basic to the concept, which is that they're these dream-like structures that were created through this moment of potential obliteration. So this very violent gesture has created mm-hmm. these utopian visions.
How big are the copper plates?
They're about 12 by 12 inches, 15 mm-hmm. by 15 inches, kind of on that scale.
And it's the same copper plate that, like, William Blake would have used to print his books.
Sure.
It hasn't changed for hundreds of years.
Just a hunk of copper.
And solid copper? Was there a backing?
No, it's solid copper. It's very thin. I think it's probably about a 16th of an inch.
Oh, okay. But you put C4 explosive on it?
It's I'm not sure exactly what kind of explosive it was. That was their department.
Yeah,
but
a
sheet of something similar to that anyway.
So it's kind of soft, mm-hmm. like clay. You put it on
exactly
in the shape of the image.
So I cut a stencil that corresponds to the image, and it's the final image that you can see in these works. So I cut a stencil, place that on top of the copper plate. The stencil is treated with some other stuff, and then the explosive sheet is laid on top of that, and this is all put out on the site Everybody actually goes back into the bunker. Mm-hmm. They sound the siren. There's a big red button. Somebody pushes the red button. There's a countdown. And then the explosive is detonated. And the blast, the pressure on the plate is buffered by the stencil. And that's how you get the image embedded in the plate.
Mm-hmm.
So the image is actually raised. And then in the final print, you can see that there's all this kind of noise. There's all this gritty stuff in the environment
scratches
around.
And things.
Yeah, exactly. And that's all created just by from the blast. So those are things that I don't have control over. And that kind of produces this halo that makes the whole image look a little bit fuzzy, like it came from another time.
So you would take the blasted copper plate and then take it to a print studio and print it on paper?
Exactly. So then that copper plate that has been shaped through the explosive blast is inked up and printed out just as you would any other intaglio etching.
Did you do it there in New Mexico, or did you take it back to your print shop?
It was produced both between New Mexico and Brooklyn.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, did you wait a long time? Were you like, can't wait to see how this looks?
Oh, I couldn't wait to see how they looked, so I wanted to print them out immediately, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I was surprised, you know, because that element of the unknown was also really, you know, really moving to me and something that I was really involved in and really excited about, the fact that you don't have control over these things. You don't have control when you put this process into motion.
Mm-hmm.
Something else could arise. And indeed, you know, all of that kind of noise, that relic of the process, is something that I couldn't have done if I had tried.
Mm-hmm. You brought in a bit of music that you listen to when you're working, and I tend to think of printmakers as working in complete silence with a bit maybe NPR on. But you've worked with explosives and things, so I don't know. When do you listen to this bit of music, and what's it called?
Yeah, no, it's interesting that you mention it now, because it really, I think, corresponds to this. There's a lot of grit in it. It's My Country of Illusion.
That's
the album, and it's American Dream Life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I listen to it mostly in my own studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have NPR going a lot of the time, I confess. but I listen to a lot of music also, and this is one of my favorites.
And let's listen to a track from My Country of Illusion.
Timeless question, forever seeking, is the constant preoccupation of scientists everywhere. Scientists famous and unknown. Scientists in great universities and modest homes. Scientists on all levels. Scientists.
That was the band American Dream Life, and the album is My Country of Illusion. So what is it about that kind of music that you can work to that?
You know, that particular track is just really rich and textural, and it's something that I can listen to carefully and find a lot in, but it can also just produce this wall of noise that... that almost hovers around me, and I can think about other things as I work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to have music that functions in both of those ways, something that I can zone out and something that I can also really tune into and be interested in.
Mm-hmm. You live and work in Brooklyn, New York. You have a studio. What's it like working? You live where you work, right?
That's right.
I mean, I know you teach. Where do you teach?
I teach at Columbia University. Yeah, and I really enjoy teaching, and for me it's just a different way to engage in what I love doing in my own studio, and it's a very different kind of interaction. But I find that teaching really feeds my own work, and then my own work really feeds back into teaching as well. So it's a good complement.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I live in Brooklyn, and it's a You know, it's a very kind of typical artist loft space. It's an industrial building that has been renovated so that it's, you know, it's got a small apartment in it, and most of it is studio. You know, and honestly, I wouldn't have it any other way. It means that that when I'm home, I'm also kind of in the middle of my work, and it's hovering in the back of my mind and kind of percolating. And, you know, even if I'm not in the studio actually with my hands dirty, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's my life. And I don't see a huge separation between them. I don't go to work at 9 o'clock and go home at 5. It all kind of flows into each other. And that's what I find to be most productive and also really most enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. I should tell the listeners that you came in with a beautiful 2-month-old baby boy called Amadeus, your son.
That's right.
How does Columbia, do they help you out with childcare?
Well, it's all new. He's only 2 months old. So we'll see how all that works out. But they've been really supportive.
So you, in foreseeable future, you'll be still teaching and still making your own work.
Yeah, no, that's right. I'll be taking a little bit of time off to be with Amadeus and be able to take care of him and enjoy these first months.
What one of the there are 3 lithographs in the show, and they're called Infrastructure +1, +2, and +3. So you took a stone, made a print, and then made a second one, and mm-hmm. with added elements. Just quickly tell me how you added things.
Yeah, this series was published by Tamarind Institute, also in New Mexico, and they're very traditional in their approach. So they like, you know, they work with only the lithography, and they really encourage artists to draw on stones. You know, mm. now lithographs are made with all sorts of different things. Use a slightly greasy pencil. So it's kind of a litho crayon,
mm-hmm.
But it's a greasy base, and you draw on it. And I drew a large stone, and then that became the infrastructure, the kind of basic image for all of these 3 pieces. So it's this architectural skeleton almost, and that skeleton image appears in each of the 3 prints. In Infrastructure +1, it's that skeleton plus a few other elements. Infrastructure +2 has several more elements layered on top. The skeleton is flipped over, it's inverted, but it's still there. And then the 3rd one is that skeleton, and then it's just mobbed on top with all sorts of other images, and it's kind of going crazy. So it's almost a sequential progression from one image to the next as this environment gets more and more congested and crazy and layered.
Mm-hmm. So you did very different things, you know, the mylar, the copper plates, the lithographs, but all these things come together in one show. Were you thinking of a show when you were doing them, or did you just assemble it at the end?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't thinking of showing these all together as they were made, but when Elizabeth and I were talking about putting a show up at the gallery and I started looking at work, I felt that they really came together mostly because of the concepts behind them, because of the stories that they tell, because of the imagery that's involved, not necessarily because the technique is consistent, because it's not. So, you know, in my studio, I find that there usually are several ideas that run through all of the works that I'm creating at any given time, even if it's, you know, the time frame of a couple of years. So they end up talking to each other, and I feel that they do that in this show.
Mm-hmm. I'm Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week was Nicola Lopez. Her show, Forecasting an Impossibly Possible Tomorrow, runs now at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery through September 27th. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Nicola.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're now approaching Newport, Rhode Island.
KBOO and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present one of the great concert films of all time, Jazz on a Summer's Day, a documentary of the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. Jazz on a Summer's Day captures the music, the crowd, and the essence of such jazz greats as Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, and Anita O'Day. Jazz on a Summer's Day, Thursday, August 14, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And that's it for public affairs programming for Tuesday, the 12th. Stay tuned. Coming right up, the noon news headlines brought to you live today. And Buscando America follows with Alejandro as your host. Stay tuned for all that on KBOO Portland.
And now, the KBOO News at Noon for August 12, 2014. Police in Missouri have fired wooden bullets at demonstrators who were protesting the recent police shooting of an unarmed teenager in St. Louis suburb. Michael Brown was killed by police Saturday, and his death has brought to the surface the underlying tension and racism in the city of St. Louis, Missouri, and its suburbs. In local news, pressure is mounting for longshoremen in Vancouver to back down on their demands for better working conditions as grain shipments are being impacted. After a two-year deadlock between the three major Northwest grain companies and unionized port workers, an end to the conflict is nowhere near in sight. Transportation of grain has been slow as agricultural inspectors are concerned for their security when they cross picket lines at the Port of Vancouver in Washington. That's all for the KBOO News at Noon for today, August 12, 2014. Tune in every week